Welcome to the jungle. The program is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage is with you every step of the way to provide a seamless mortgage experience. Still kind of reveling in that playback from the edge. Nothing like the U. The U was one of the greatest things, not just in college football, but in all of sports. The U in its heyday, I've never seen anything like that, man. The absolute incredible and unmatched swag of the U. The pride, the swag, like just the cult of personality, their brand of ball, where they played, how they carried themselves. I mean, it could never be like that ever again. I never get tired of talking about the U or talking to guys who played at the U and what it meant to them. And the Edge was really good on that. I'm always here for that. It makes everything better. So I would never say, man, if they could just go back to being like it was then, because it'll never be like that. One, you can't go back, no matter what, in anything. But you really can't go back to that. It would never be like that ever again, which is why I bring it up any chance I can and talk about it anytime I can. 1-800-636-8686. Edge was really good like that. Yes. All right, so, as promised, I've got a very busy third hour. In this third hour, I've got a conversation about BYU football. Zach Wilson's the quarterback there. I was going to have a conversation with my next guest next segment, but I want to start at the top of the hour because I want to make sure we had enough real estate for this. We are joined right now by somebody who led the LA Lakers to the 1980 NBA championship. He led the Phoenix Mercury to the 2007 WNBA title. He was a two-time WCC Coach of the Year at Loyola Marymount. He's got a brand new book out. It's called The Speed Game, My Fast Times in Basketball. It is available right now on Amazon. I'm joined by Paul Westhead. Paul, it's so nice to have you on the program. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, Jim. Thank you.
It's good to talk to you, Paul. There's so many things that we can talk about and will, but I want to start at the start of the book. You make a really interesting point to start the book when you say you won an NBA title in 1980, but 18 months later you were fired. At that time, Paul, a beat writer asked you, quote, "Why did you insert your fast break system with a Laker team that had just won a world championship with a proven style of play? You had a new contract. Owner Jerry Buss proclaimed that you were the best coach in the world. Why, Paul, why mess with success?" End of quote. So that's where you start the book. Paul, let me ask you, how would you answer that question?
Yeah, well, in addition to Scott Osler, the beat writer for the LA Times, and asking that question, my wife also asked the question, why, Paul, why?
Great.
And 20 jobs later, she's still asking me, why did you do that? So the answer is that I had this concept of fast break basketball that was running through my veins, and I just wanted to do it. So I took a chance, and sometimes it worked. Like the Phoenix Mercury and Loyola Marymount, and other times it didn't, and I got fired. So it just was the way I wanted to play.
Paul Westhead joining us. You mentioned Scott Osler. Paul, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I used to talk to Scott Osler. Man, he was an amazing... It's funny that you talk about him being a beat writer because he was an amazing columnist. I used to kind of laugh with him, Paul. He actually worked at the Lompoc Record way back in the day. Those were some heady times, but what about Osler? He was a great columnist, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah, Scott and I became, you know, friendly when I was coaching the Lakers and he worked for the LA Times. And on the road, we'd go out for long distance runs. We were both wannabe runners, so we'd do a 10-mile run day of the game.
Now, yeah, that's something. Now, if we go back a little bit, as you write in the book, after you graduated from St. Joseph's, you had a fellowship at Villanova and you were studying English Lit. Who were you studying, and what were those days like?
Now, they were some of the happiest days of my life. I had 2 years as a student, as an academic, doing the academic life. My master's thesis is on William Shakespeare's play, Titus Andronicus, which, fortunately, other than me, no one in the world has ever read. So I could probably be a genius on Titus Andronicus, and no one would know. But I just love those times of just being a student and going to the library and doing academic life.
Paul Westhead is joining us right now. He's got a brand new book out. So, Paul, if you were studying Shakespeare and you did your thesis on Shakespeare, how much were you thinking about being a basketball coach at that point? How did you get into coaching? Did you grow up dreaming of being a coach?
Yeah, well, when I was at St. Joe's, I played for, you know, Dr. Jack Ramsey, and I always admired him and his way of dealing with people. While I was at Villanova, about to graduate, there were a couple local coaching jobs opening up, and I asked him to help me out, and he said, "I'll make a call for you." He said, "But I don't think you're going to be a very good coach." He said, I think you belong in the classroom." So he made some calls. I eventually went to the University of Dayton, and I became the freshman coach at UD for a year with Jack Ramsey's help. And then everything went from there. I became a high school teacher and coach back in Philly, and then to LaSalle, and then to the Lakers.
Paul Westhead is joining us. His new book is called The Speed Game, My Fast Times in Basketball. You know, Paul, what's really interesting to me is you write that you went to a Bobby Knight coaching clinic and that initially you were a Bobby Knight style coach, quote, a classic hard ass do it by the book coach. And you were happy to win a defensive struggle without any fast breaks. It seems really hard for me to picture you like that. What did you think, or what do you think, when you look back on that time and that philosophy you had?
Yeah, it's unbelievable, Jim. And as I have in the book, I took the Bobby Knight drills, my first practice as a new coach. I run my first drill where two players dive in the center of the court for a loose ball, and my star player breaks his collarbone on the first play of my first practice. And I said, "Wow, this life is not that easy." But I look back, and I had a reunion with my high school team about 10 years ago, which incidentally they're the only team of my 20 coaching positions that invited me back. So that tells you something.
Wow.
And they said that I was no fun to be around. Like, I was demanding and tough and made them do hard defensive drills. And so I got that out of my system, though, Jim. I don't do that anymore.
Good, good. Paul Westhead joining us. So, Paul, for those, this is all really funny. I mean, it's all so interesting. For those who do not know, how did you first then discover the running game? And then what was that moment like for you?
Well, in the 70s, when I was at LaSalle, during the summers, I went to San Juan, Puerto Rico, and coached in the leagues down there. They had summer basketball leagues. And I had notions about fast break, and the Puerto Rican players embraced my notions. I mean, they looked at me like, mira, I love this. So the players and I joined together, and I became a running coach in the summertime, and I just brought it back up to LaSalle. And I also met Sonny Allen then, who was a coach at Old Dominion University, and he gave me his system. He said, "I have to warn you, you have to be a little crazy to do this." I said, "Well, I qualify." So then I went and did it.
Paul Westhead is my guest. He's got a brand new book out. It's called The Speed Game, My Fast Times in Basketball. Paul, I actually know Sonny. Sonny used to come on the show quite a bit, and I go back with him as well. Sonny, he was a coach's coach now, but he did do it a different way. And as Sonny and you discussed it, like, anybody can run a fast break a few times. Anybody can defend it a few times. But when you get to that, I don't know, 82nd or 83rd time in the game, that's when other teams want nothing to do with it. What did it feel like when the other team would just give up?
Well, you knew it was coming, and your players knew it was coming. Like, we used to estimate we were going to have 100 offensive possessions. And somewhere along the line, 60, 70, 75, you could see the look in their eyes. The opposition, you know, looked at you like, we don't want any more of this. We're done. Please stop. And our players would just blow right through. So you knew it was coming. It makes me remember one time we played the Holy Cross from back east at LMU, and we won like 120 to 105. And I knew the coach. So afterwards, I was chatting with him, and I said, "George, your team played well. They hung in. They did a good job." He said, "No, they were done with 10 minutes to go in the game." I said, no, they played well." He said, "No, I don't mean my players. I mean the officials."
Ah. Right.
With 10 minutes to go, they stopped. One stood at one end, the other stood in the middle, and the other stood at the far end. He said they never moved for the last 10 minutes.
So the officials are tapping out with 10 minutes left. Paul Westhead joining us, but that's what that style would do. The book is called The Speed Game, My Fast Times in Basketball. Paul, I went to UC Santa Barbara as a student, and then I stayed in that town, and I worked and got my broadcasting career there, and the Gauchos used to schedule, or LMU would schedule UCSB, and you'd come into the building, so I remember those days pretty clearly. You coached Hank Gathers and Bo Kimble, of course, at Loyola Marymount, and as you write, you look like a genius. What did it feel like when it all clicked the way that it did at LMU with those players?
Yeah, it was kind of magical, Jim, to tell you the truth. We our players knew what they could do, and they thought this was the only way to play. They would look at games on TV and say to me, Coach, it was so boring, I turned the game off. That was just regular basketball. We played different, Coach, and they knew it. So it was really, I gave it to them, but it was their game. And speaking of UCSB, I remember going up to the Thunderdome and playing Jerry Pym and that group, and we always had some knockout games up there.
Oh, man, I love that you remember that, like that. When Jerry Pym came in there, you guys had some great, great games there. What about Hank? Paul, Hank Gathers, he was larger than life, and not just as a scorer, but as a rebounder, an absolute force on defense. What was he like as a teammate?
Well, as a teammate, he was very demanding. Hank worked as hard, if not harder, than anybody. And he never took a drill or a play or a game off. He was always pushing. He wanted the ball. He wanted to be the center of basketball. If he wasn't shooting, he was going to rebound somebody else's shot. So Hank was, well, as you know, he led the country in scoring and rebounding in his junior year. So he was a nonstop talented athlete who just attacked.
Paul Westhead is joining us. Paul, in the book, you write about the game against the University of Portland where Hank collapsed, and you write that you don't remember what you were thinking, but you remember seeing him try to sit up and then fall back down, and then you remember the silence in the gym. How did you and the team go about processing Hank's passing and life without him? Because obviously there is no playbook for something like that.
Yeah, that was a very difficult time. It was 30 years ago now, and it seems like 3 minutes ago, but after the funeral services, one held at LMU and then one back at his church in North Philadelphia, where all the players and I attended, we came back and the players said, Coach, we want to keep going. And so we practiced and we went into the NCAA tournament. And they played for Hank, but they also were playing to give them a chance to forget the grief that they were going through. For 2 hours a day, they were kids in the schoolyard playing. And then the rest of the time, their thoughts were on Hank Gathers.
And Paul, what do you remember about, and not to single him out because the players played with so much heart and so much passion and so much courage, but what about Bo Kimble? When you think about Bo Kimble at that time and the way he played, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Yeah, well, Bo kind of took over the team. You know, he never was shy either, like Hank. So Bo didn't mind saying, well, give me the ball, and I'll take all the shots. But I do remember the first NCAA tournament game against New Mexico State. 10 minutes into the game, Bo gets fouled going to the basket, so he's going to shoot two free throws. And then everything stops because he had announced that he was going to shoot left-handed for his fallen teammate, Hank Gathers. I had chills watching him bounce the ball, cup it in his left hand, and release the ball, and miraculously, it goes in. And there was a great sense of relief after that.
I mean, I didn't even want to pose the question. I wonder what that would have been like had he not made it, but then again, there was maybe not a chance that he was not going to not make that. That was an amazing moment, wasn't it? An amazing moment when he made that free throw left-handed.
Yeah, Jim. Knowing Bo, if he not made it, he probably would have went in, rebounded his own, and dunked it.
No doubt. Paul Westhead joining us. You know, Paul, you are known as the guru of Go, and the NBA has made a move to pace and space in terms of style. I'm curious, like, when you watch the NBA game right now, I mean, is this the way you've always envisioned basketball, or is it maybe still a little slower than what you'd like to see?
Yeah, you know, I would like to take some credit, but, you know, I watch a lot of games. I saw all of the playoff series with the Lakers, and I really don't see a lot of running. This is not the style that I advocated. You know, as I say, if we had it 100 times, we ran and shot within 4 or 5 seconds every possession. The Lakers and other prominent teams, they run occasionally. And see, deep down, Jim, players don't want to run. They say they do, but they want to go at a very steady, even pace. I did see flares of it, like Anthony Davis a few times after Miami would score a basket. He would sprint the lane, and they'd throw a lead lob to him ahead of the defense, and he'd slam dunk with nobody around him. Well, we did that routinely. But basketball is not as fast as I ever played it.
Talking to Paul Westhead. Paul, before I let you go, I want to follow up on one thing you mentioned. You talked about when you were coaching in San Juan in Puerto Rico in the summer. There was a time, actually, back then, when guys like Phil Jackson, Raleigh Massimino, my guy Dale Harris, they were coaching there, too. What was that entire experience like?
Oh, it was the greatest. Yeah, you mentioned some of the figures down there. In addition to that, P.J. Carlissimo was down there with us. Jim Boeheim was down there. Jimmy Lynam was down there. We would sit around on the beach all day and with our families enjoy life on the water. And then we would coach at night, and then we would talk about it. I mean, there wasn't a better time than those summers in Puerto Rico with the coaches and those players.
I was just going to say, it sounds like an absolute blast. Had to be the best time of life. Paul Westhead led the Lakers to that championship in 1980, led the Phoenix Mercury to a WNBA title in 07. He was a two-time WCC Coach of the Year. He's got a brand new book. It's called The Speed Game, My Fast Times in Basketball. You can get this book on Amazon right now. Paul, that was great. So good to get caught up with you. Congrats on that book, and I really appreciate that conversation.
Thanks, Jim. I didn't know you were a Gaucho.
Oh, yeah. I'm a proud Gaucho. I'm a proud Gaucho. I was there before Jerry Pym got there, before Brian Shaw got there. So I remember coming in.
Yep.
Jerry could coach now, right?
Yes. Yes, he could. He was tough. He was good.
He was tough. All right, Paul. Great talking to you. Thanks so much. I am a Gaucho forever. All right. Paul Westhead. That was good. That was fun. I was hoping that would go exactly like that. Great sense of humor. Good anecdotes. Good stuff. Paul Westhead throwing it back. All right. 1-800-636-8686. You get chills hearing the stories about LMU and Hank Gathers and Bo Kimble in the NCAA tournament shooting that free throw left-handed to honor his teammate. I remember the Thunderdome he mentioned. I always get such a kick out of that when guys went into the Thunderdome. For those of you who don't know, Thunderdome is the on-campus arena where UC Santa Barbara plays. We have 6,000 people. And the Thunderdome got a lot of run back in the day when UNLV was in the Big West, and the Gauchos would go up against UNLV on Big West or on Big Monday on ESPN. And those were the days when Grandmama was there, Greg Anthony was there, Mo Scurry, Anderson Hunt, Jerry Tarkanian. So the Thunderdome got a lot of run, and the Thunderdome was famous then. But I remember Hank Gathers coming in. And, man, he was larger than life. Hank Gathers was incredible. Led the nation, as he points out, in scoring and rebounding. My man was like Charles Barkley. And he was athletic, and he could get up and down, and he was fierce. That was, like, such a tragic, sad, sad thing. And when they went on that run in the NCAA tournament after he passed, and Bo Kimble shot that free throw left-handed and made it, That was really, really amazing and moving. Still yet, I got chills with him relating that story. All right, still to come, I've got Zach Wilson, BYU quarterback, joining us. There is so much history there. I can remember Bo Kimble coming on our talk show talked to on ESPN at that time. Really emotional stuff. When we come back, kind of a shorter segment to set up the last segment, but if you want to get through, you can call right now, or you can hit me up on Twitter at Jim Rome. Stay tuned. More to come.
You're listening to The Jim Rome Show.
Paul Westhead, that was fun. Had to throw it back. He was funny. He was self-deprecating. I love that thing about, 20 years later, my wife is still asking me that same question. Scott Osler, he mentioned, as the beat writer. One thing better than a Scott Osler reference is a Scott Osler is a beat writer reference. Those of you in Southern California who used to read the LA Times, a newspaper, we used to read them. They used to come to our house and read them every single day. Scott Osler was one of the best sports columnists I ever read. Ever. Not just growing up or not even at that time in my life. He was so good. Such a talented guy. And I used to talk to Scott Osler. If you're in Southern California, if you're somebody in LA and you're of that age, you remember. You know what I'm talking about. And I always got a huge kick because I was always fascinated by the media and where people started, where people worked, where they ended up. The fact that he worked for the Lompoc Record was incredible. Like Scott Osler, a legendary columnist, one of the best to ever do it, worked in Lompoc. Then you got this guy. Vic and NoCal is back with more. He tweets, "You always got to secure the bag." Signed, Art Modell. Vic, as you know, the phrase is secure the bag, not secure the sack. Or secure the scrotum. It's secure the bag, Vic. You know this. Let's not get this twisted. Looking for a telephone call, 1-800-636-8686. I've got Zach Wilson coming up next segment. Let's go to Orange County here in Southern California, not too far from where I am. Mike, about time to get a phone call in here. Mike in Orange County.
Hey,
Mike, how are you?
What's
up?
Spencer, Jim, Paul Westhead, that was incredible. Two iconic teams. Obviously, the Lakers in 80, right? And then the Marymount team he talked about with Hank. I mean, he's a big part of Southern California basketball, you know, an important part of Southern California basketball, you know, with the Lakers and then with Loyola. That was an incredible Loyola. Whoever was here to see that, I mean, I remember when Hank went down that night, that was like the WCC final, right? And I just couldn't believe it. And then the run they went on with Bo and the free throws. And it was just unbelievable.
It really was. I got to ask you something, Mike. Thank you. Like, dude, are you like cowering in a closet in the darkness with the door closed, hiding from an axe murderer? Why do you talk like that? Why is that your vibe? Is that like your shtick? Where are you making that phone call from? It sounds like you're in a closet, honestly. Like you've barricaded yourself in the closet and you're calling 911. Like, yeah, hello, 911. There's somebody who got into my house and I think they have an axe and I think they've got a chainsaw. Can you please send somebody right away? I'm really scared. 911, what is your emergency? Can you speak up? No, I'm in a closet. I think somebody's coming to get me. And then you take this whole vibe to me in the jungle. Hi, Jim. Paul Westhead was amazing. Like, he was front and center for two of the most iconic franchises or teams here in Los Angeles. Hey, Mike, is there somebody in your house trying to get you? No, I just love LMU and the Lakers. Bro, like, come out of the closet. Get some sun. Speak clearly into your phone. And if somebody's coming to get you, don't call me. Call 911. What's going on with you, man? Let's try somebody else. Rit. Let's Let's go to South Carolina. Sue in South Carolina. Hi, Sue. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you very much. I called because I was listening to the radio and you were talking about Hank Gathers.
Yes.
And the night that Hank Gathers died, soon after they described what had happened to him, and he was diagnosed with sick sinus syndrome, which means the heart doesn't automatically do the shock treatment that it needs to palpitate. And I looked at my husband and I said, Bob, that's what I've been diagnosed as. And a couple of days later, I went back to the doctor and happened to have that same episode that killed Hank in his office. Hmm. And the cardiologist said to me, you have an athletic heart. And I looked at him and I said, do you mean like Hank Gathers? And he said, yes, that's exactly what I mean. It's a time bomb waiting to go off. Bring your husband to the office tomorrow. And from there, I went and had a simple pacemaker put in. And I'm now 75 years old, and I'm on about my fourth pacemaker. But I would not have had it done had I not seen that report on Hank Gathers. And every time I tell my story of what happened, I credit Hank Gathers with saving my life. Of course, my doctor and the grace of God. But also, I heard his mother talking several times about it. And I thought, what a tragedy. Before I knew, what a tragedy. And I just, as I said, every day I thank God that I happened to be listening to that, because it was Hank Gathers that made me go and do more about this. And I was probably, you said it was about 30 years ago, so I was early 40s, maybe 30-something, but they thought I was too young to have a pacemaker. I had two children, a husband, and a business, and I thought, this is crazy.
Boy, Sue, it is such a good thing, isn't it? Isn't it such a good thing that you went in and you took care of that? And now look, and then you happen to hear us today listening on the radio. That is an amazing story, Sue. I'm so glad you shared that with us.
War Lady Clones.
Easy, Rit. So Sue shares that story, and she credits Hank Gathers, as tragic as that was, with saving her life. And the doctor. Much respect, Sue in South Carolina. I wonder what Sue, isn't that amazing? Like, that's probably, obviously, one of the amazing happenstances or stories of her entire life. And, like, when was the last time Hank Gathers came up as a topic on this show? Not very often. And I've got profound respect for Hank, and that's a very, very sad story. But again, as I mentioned, because I'm from Southern California and I lived and worked in Santa Barbara, I would see Hank and LMU, and I have very, very vivid recollections, obviously. It's a famous story. But I wonder about Sue. Like, Sue said she was listening on the radio. And how unusual that Paul Westhead would be on this program. First time maybe ever, and if not ever, then in years and years and years. And that Sue would stop on that station, wherever she was listening, and hear that story, when that story played such a prominent role in her life. Pretty amazing. Let's see. I mean, you guys, you idiots. Like this guy, 45 got fat, tweets, can you run Sue? Please. Oh, since you said please, Howie. Why would I run Sue? Sue is 75. Sue had an amazing story to tell. Sue has a lot to share. What? Why? I can run you, Howie. But why would I run her? No. Rit, stop pushing the buttons, old man. You're totally out of hand, Rit. You're not making it better. You've settled in a bad way, Rit. Don't push any buttons other than the one that gets me to and out of break. What I was going to say is, did you notice that not only did I not run Sue, I gave her runway. Did you notice that? Did you notice I let her go and go and go? Because I respect her and the years that she's had on this planet and the wisdom that she has to share with the rest of us. So, quote, can I run her? Yes, I can do whatever the hell I want. It's my show. But why would I want to? Idiot. Look at this guy. Kenan S.A. Hey, Rome, rack that call from Edith Bunker. Stop. Stop doing it. Because this poor gal is going to be like, well, I don't understand. I called that handsome young man on the radio, and we were having a conversation, and now people are saying really mean things about me. How would I explain that to her? How could anybody explain any of you losers to somebody like that? Leave her alone. Stop doing it. Stop doing it. Chris in St. Pete. Hearing Sue tell her story is like anytime my parents call me and they talk and they talk and 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 never get to a point. No, she had a point. She got to her point, and maybe she restated her point once or twice. I'm not reading any more of these, idiots. Stop doing it. I got to get out. I really have to get out. Time now for a break. Back. I'm Jim Rome. One last segment. Let's get right at it. Kind of a crazy day here in the jungle, but in a good way. We're joined right now by the quarterback for BYU, coming off an enormous game. He was 19 of 25 for 287 yards. He had four touchdowns in that win over Texas State. On the season, he is completing better than 78% of his passes. He's thrown for nearly 2,000 yards, 16 touchdowns. He has rushed for six more. BYU is 6-0, and they're number 10 in the coaches' poll. They are hosting Western Kentucky on Saturday. Zach Wilson is my guest. Zach, great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good, good. Listen, there's a play I want to ask you about going back to that game this past weekend. A play where, watching it, it seemed borderline impossible. It's that touchdown to Dax Milne where you're at midfield, you're moving to your right, you throw to the opposite corner of the field, you hit him perfectly, you made it look easy. What do you remember about that play, and what did you see?
Yeah, you know, it was a fun one to end half that way, but, you know, really, I picked that up from film study. I noticed these guys were a team that likes to stare at the quarterback's eyes, especially when the play broke down a little bit, especially when he wasn't in rhythm, the quarterback moved out of the pocket. And so one thing I studied in film, especially in a two-minute situation, is sometimes when a quarterback will leave the pocket a little bit, the safeties will start to flow with the field. And, you know, I would say that backside safety probably doesn't expect you to throw the ball all the way across the field on a go route in drop eight. But it was something I noticed, especially in the SMU game. You know, I kept thinking, man, shoot, if that quarterback just saw his backside guy is running a streak and the backside safety has no idea he's there, you know, maybe he has a shot. So right as we called the play, you know, that was just something I had in the back of my mind. And when I left the pocket a little bit to the right, I just saw the backside safety not able to get there if I was able to get the ball to him. And so it was fun to execute on a play like that, something that we've worked on and that I've seen on film.
Fun to watch. BYU quarterback Zach Wilson joining us. You know, it's just a number of unbelievable highlights, one of a number that you put up over the course of the year. I want to ask you about the mental side of the game too. For example, I know you had the chance to watch Drew Brees train. I know you've studied him pretty closely. What did you learn from watching him and the way he approached it?
Yeah, really, that it's no accident that he's the best. You know, going out there and seeing the way that he prepares and the way that he takes the field is unlike anything else. You know, there are some other NFL guys, other quarterbacks that were there, and no one still approached it the way he did. You know, that guy, they would have a 10 a.m. throwing session plan, and he was showing up at 8 a.m. by himself to make sure that he got everything else he needed in before the throwing session, and that he was, you know, he came out with his script, exactly the routes he wanted to work on, you know, maybe some coverage he was thinking about in his head, what type of ball he was throwing against what look. And so he just took everything to the next level, and he was so dialed in his mentality of wanting to be a great was always there.
Talking to Zach Wilson, you know, when I mentioned some of your numbers off the top, as a result of those numbers, your name is getting a lot of run right now as one of the leading candidates for the Heisman Trophy. I know you're focused on what's in front of you, but that's a reality. You're getting a lot of attention for that. What is your reaction when you see that and you hear that?
Yeah, you know, it's a blessing. You know, that's what I tell everyone. And when guys on the team bring it up, you know, I really just tell them, you know, this is a team award. You know, you can't win the Heisman unless you guys are winning games and you're dominating opponents. And so, you know, I'm thankful for the coaches I have, the O-line that has gotten me the time to throw, and the receivers that are just making plays all year long. And so really, it's a reflection on how successful our season's been up to this point.
You know, it has been, Zach, but when you look at it, you're having an amazing year. The team's having a great year. Individually, you're a team captain. You're a Heisman candidate. It all seems to fit together perfectly. But if we were to go back, you said, quote, if I had to put money down in my senior year of high school, I would have said BYU would be the last school that I would go to. End of quote. That's really fascinating. Lay that out for me. What do you mean by that? And what was your recruitment like?
Yeah, I was a Utah fan growing up. I got into the recruiting process and kind of, you know, my bias switched away from schools. I wasn't, you know, I would say in the recruiting process, that wasn't a school I really wanted to go to, was Utah. You know, I really didn't care to go there. I was happy with Boise State, super pumped to go there. Had offers with Cal and Iowa that were intriguing and, you know, thought about those other schools. But with BYU, you know, they really never showed any interest. You know, I was going through the recruiting process. There was times Ty Detmer maybe came and saw me throw, but, you know, I wasn't the quarterback on his board. And, you know, already I felt like the program itself wasn't something I wanted to be a part of, you know, whether it was the past coaching staff of offensive guys that they had there. You know, I didn't love it, and I didn't love, you know, kind of what they had going on. And so I was totally fine not being a part of the program. And end of my senior year, you know, BYU ends a terrible 4-9 season. And you know, I remember thinking, geez, like if Boise loses to BYU this year, man, those guys are terrible. Like they can't lose to them. Like it was kind of one of those things. And,
wow.
You know, just even a couple months down the road, I get a call from Kalani, and you know, he's fired his offensive staff, and you know he wants me. And you know, I always loved Kalani as a coach, and he wants me. And then even Coach A-Rod from Utah coming over was huge. I really respected and liked him a lot. And really, Coach Fessy, the coach over at Weber State that came over, was one of my favorite coaches I've ever met and grown to love through recruiting. And, you know, really it was because of those guys that I wanted to come and be a part of that whole thing.
Zach Wilson joining us. So you have a big shakeup on the offensive staff. You mentioned Kalani. This is a big Kalani Sitake house. What has he been like to play for?
Yeah, really just a loving guy. The culture he creates, you know, I really think that's a head coach's job. You know, it's really not the scheme that a head coach puts together, but it's the way that he gets his players to play. And, you know, he teaches us how to love one another, how to bring energy on the field, how to play with really just like full heart, loving it, playing for our families, the right reasons you should play the game of football. You know, he definitely creates an energy before the games, whether it's, you know, dancing in front of the team, getting the guys going. And so, you know, the culture he creates at BYU has been amazing.
Before you go, Zach, let me ask you this. You are one of the team captains, so I'm curious, what does the honor mean to you, and then how have you gone about approaching your leadership role during a pretty unusual season?
Yeah, you know, it's been ups and downs, right? I played as a freshman, maybe not the greatest sophomore, you know, campaign or whatever, but the off season was a big challenge for me to try and step up and rally the guys together, and maybe even a lot of them didn't believe that I was a leader at the time, even in this off season, right? Not believing maybe I was supposed to be the quarterback this year. You know, everything was a competition, and you know, honestly for me, I never felt like it was a competition. I felt like I knew I was going to win the job, and I felt like the coaches had that belief in me too, but it was something I felt like I had to prove to my teammates. And you know, going into the season and even fall camp, I felt like they started to realize that, and I feel like because they felt that I earned it, that, you know, it really meant a lot more. And I feel like you know, going through these last couple games with them and the adversity we've had over the last couple of years has really all added up, and it really just means way more now. You know, I would give anything for those guys, and you know, I can tell they'd give anything for me. And so it's been a roller coaster, but it's good to be where we're at right now.
You know, so you have all that. You're dealing with all that, and you're overcoming all that, all those challenges and the adversity. But let's not forget, I mean, it was not that long ago that it looked like there might not be a season at all. The program was scrambling to find opponents, and now you're 6-0 and you're top 10. In that regard, what has the year been like?
Yeah, it's been amazing. You know, truly, truly crazy that we've played the games that we have. And, you know, I remember just you know, so much doubt whether we were going to be able to play or not. I remember I was super upset, you know, thinking about, man, if this season's canceled, you know, I worked so hard, prepared for this year. I feel so much better. I'm so much healthier. You know, like, this is the year for us as a team. I was worried about some of the guys that might just end up declaring for the draft, whether it was like Harris or Matt, because of the, you know, the situation that we had. But, you know, I'm glad they ended up pulling games for us. I'm glad that, you know, everyone around the country is starting to come through and play football. And, you know, we've battled through a lot, but everyone's had their head up the whole time. You know, we all were expecting that we play games. And so we're happy to be where we're at now.
Knock on wood, BYU, and where they're at right now is 6-0 and number 10 in the coaches' poll. They're at home on Saturday against Western Kentucky, 10:15 p.m. Eastern. Their quarterback is Zach Wilson. That's how you close the show. Zach, appreciate that. Great job. Thank you very much. Good to have you on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was great, Zach. Well done. He handled his business, as Edge would say. He's about his business.
That's whack.
Rip, the hell are you doing? Dell Technologies advisors listen to your small business needs so they can provide you with tailored tech solutions powered by Intel vPro platform. Call a Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. Ritz all up in here playing "That's Whack" at the end of the show. Dude, like, I thought you had this thing figured out. I was wrong. Anyway, he's doing what we asked him to do. Not very well, but he is. So credit for that. My thanks to Zach Wilson and BYU. BYU is a good jungle program. Paul Westhead came in. Doc Emmerich was in. It's a really interesting show. Look for episode 149 of the Jim Rome Podcast with Edgerrin James. Y'all have a great day. See you tomorrow. We're out.